and Dr. Leventhal is on the stand. Would you raise your right hand? Do you swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cardella, you may proceed.
Good morning, Dr. Leventhal.
Good morning.
Would you please state your name and current position for the record?
My name is Bennett Leventhal. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago.
And could you please spell your name for the record?
My first name is spelled B-E-N-N-E-T-T, and my last name is spelled L-E-V-E-N-T-H-A-L.
And would you please briefly just review your educational background since high school?
I completed my undergraduate training at Louisiana State University. Then I went to medical school at Louisiana State University in New Orleans. I was a house officer first year at Charity Hospital in New Orleans and completed my residency in general psychiatry and child and adolescent psychiatry at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina.
And do you hold any board certifications?
I'm board certified in general psychiatry, and I'm also board certified in child and adolescent psychiatry.
And do you hold any licenses?
I'm licensed to practice medicine in North Carolina, Virginia, Louisiana, Indiana, and Illinois.
And would you briefly describe your academic employment history?
When I finished my residency, I was on the clinical faculty at Duke while I was in the Navy and was also on the faculty at Eastern Virginia Medical School. Then I moved to the University of Chicago, starting there part-time in 1978, full-time in 1980, and I remained there until 2005 when I moved to the University of Illinois.
And are you a member of any professional societies or organizations?
I'm a member of a lot of them.
Highlight a few for us, please.
Probably too many. American Psychiatric Association, American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, American Association for Advancement of Psychiatry, Society for Biological Psychiatry. I don't know. That's probably enough.
And have you ever been honored for your work in autism specifically?
I've been fortunate enough to be honored a couple times.
Could you just describe a few of those honors?
I've received awards organization called MAP, which is the More Able Autistic Persons, High Functioning Autistic Individuals. It's families. I've been honored by that organization. And I recently learned that I'm going to receive an award from the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry for lifetime achievement in work with individuals with developmental disabilities.
And when did you learn about that honor?
Last week.
You mentioned that you're currently at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Do you hold any teaching positions there or in your specialty?
I'm a professor of psychiatry.
A full professor?
I'm a full professor with tenure.
Great. How long have you been teaching?
I started teaching when I was a resident, but I've been teaching for 30 years or more.
Who do you teach?
I teach residents in general psychiatry, fellows in child and adolescent psychiatry, medical students, residents in pediatrics, nursing students, social work students, students in psychology, and then I have graduate students who work with me on their PhDs.
And what do you teach?
I teach broadly in the area of child and adolescent psychiatry, but probably spend most of my time teaching about developmental disorders and issues in normal and atypical child development, not just restricted to autism and developmental disorders, although that's a large portion of my work.
Do you teach the diagnosis and assessment of autism and other autism spectrum disorders?
I do.
Okay. Do you teach internationally?
I do.
Could you explain how you teach internationally?
Well, I'm involved in a couple of organizations that are interested in advancing child and adolescent psychiatry practice and research, and so I work with a group in Europe called the European Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I also work with a group in the Middle East called the Eastern Mediterranean Association of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, where I go every year and teach. We've done a lot of work in autism and developmental disorders there. And then I do some work in Korea, and I've also taught many other countries, China, Japan, Australia, New Zealand.
And who do you teach when you teach internationally?
Mostly physicians, both in psychiatry, but also pediatrics and pediatric neurology. But also psychologists, I suppose, and then students in each of those places.
Do you also give lectures to professional groups or organizations about autism spectrum disorders?
I do.
To whom?
Again, mostly to medical groups, although also to psychologists, educators, special educators in particular. But physicians in psychiatry, child and adolescent psychiatry, and pediatrics, pediatric neurology primarily.
And how often would you say that you give lectures?
It'd be unusual for me to go more than a week without giving a public lecture, maybe 2 weeks. So I suspect I give somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 a year.
Do you also lecture internationally?
I do.
Do you devote time to family-based organizations pertaining to autism?
I do.
Could you explain what you do?
Well, I work, as I indicated before, with the MAP organization, with the Autism Society of America, with the local autism societies in Illinois, and not just with the state organization, but the regional organizations. I work with them, and occasionally in other states, so particularly in Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, I work with folks in those areas. And occasionally back, I'm from Louisiana, so occasionally go back home and help out there. I've been more so since the hurricane because they've had a shortage of folks.
I'd like to talk about your experience as a child psychiatrist over the past 30 years, specifically as it pertains to autism spectrum disorders. Do you currently have a clinical practice?
I do. I'm not in private practice. I never have been. I'm in a university-based practice, but I see patients through that practice.
Could you describe your clinical practice?
Well, when I'm in town and not lecturing or doing other things, I probably see about 20 hours of patients a week. Probably three-quarters of those are developmentally disabled individuals.
Are you affiliated with any hospital?
The University of Illinois Hospital, and I'm also affiliated with a local hospital in Chicago called Chicago Lakeshore Hospital, where we have our teaching inpatient service.
As part of your clinical practice, do you diagnose children with autism spectrum disorders?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
Approximately how many times have you diagnosed a child with an ASD?
I'm sure it's thousands.
Over the course of your career?
Yes, ma'am.
Approximately how many do you diagnose per month?
Well, it sort of depends on the month and what my travel schedule is, but what we're doing at the time. Right now we're engaged in a very large study, and so I might see as many as 2 to 3 new cases a week when I'm in town. Sometimes it's as little as 1 to 2 a week or 1 a week. So somewhere between 50 and 200 new cases a year.
As part of your clinical practice, do you treat children with autism?
Yes, ma'am.
Approximately how many are you currently following?
Well, since they never go away, they're with me forever, which is great. So I follow all my kids into adulthood. And so if you do it long enough, 30 years, I have probably 400, 500, 600 kids. They're not all kids anymore, but they're kids to me.
So. What's the age range of your patient population?
Oh, 1.5 to 50, 60.
Do you meet with parents as part of your clinical practice?
Absolutely. Can't practice without parents.
Why is that?
Well, there are lots of reasons. First of all, they're the ones who are in charge. They make the decisions. Secondly, we need them. I mean, they're the ones that have the information. They know the child far better than we ever will. And they are the ones that end up having to bear the burden. So supporting them, making sure they understand what I understand, and I understand what they're thinking and feeling for themselves, their child, and their other kids is part of the practice. I mean, one of the problems in autism practice is that the stress on families is just gigantic. They have very high divorce rates, very high stress levels in the families. And so if we're going to treat the child, we have to manage the stress levels in the family and keep the families together. So it's an inherent part of the practice. Can't do it without it.
Do you meet with other family members besides the parents?
Always. When I get done with an evaluation, one of the things I do is I'll meet with the parents, go through our findings, but then I routinely offer to meet with everybody in the family. So it's not uncommon that grandmothers, aunts, uncles, grandfathers, cousins will come in. We sometimes have to use a large conference room, and I explain to them what the disorder is and what we understand about it, what the treatment's going to be, and then I ask them to play a role, both in supporting the family, but also sometimes there are things they can do quite specifically. And we also pay particularly close attention to the children, the siblings, because depends on the developmental level and so on, but they bear a significant burden as well, and they need to the extent that they can understand, we want to explain it to them. To the extent that they want to help, we want to help them help. To the extent that they want some of their own time away from it, we help set that up. So we have to include them in the process as well.
When a child is brought to you for an evaluation, are you the one who makes the evaluation?
Yes.
Do you take the history yourself?
I take it myself, and I do my own physical exams, and I do the entire process with my own hands, eyes, and ears.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you currently have a study underway. Do you also have a research practice?
I have a rather large research practice.
Could you describe your research practice?
Well, we're doing a number of studies. Right now, I'm a part of one of the five NIH-designated Autism Centers of Excellence. So we have...
What's an Autism Center of Excellence?
The National Institute of Health a couple years ago decided that they needed to create centers that had the capacity to bring a lot of expertise to bear on the study of autism, and they had a competition amongst various academic centers around the country, and there were five or six selected to receive large grants to set up the infrastructure to provide the research support in autism, and we're one of those centers.
And when you say we, who's we?
Well, there are a large group of us scientists and clinicians who are involved in the center. Ed Cook is the principal investigator. I'm one of the co-investigators, and I run actually the clinical core for that center. So I'm responsible for all the evaluations for all the patients that are in those studies. And then we're doing a number of research projects ranging from MRI studies, brain imaging studies, to pharmacogenetic studies, understanding how genes may predict the response to certain medications, to understanding some of the very critical elements of the disorder, and one in particular is the difficulties with insistence on sameness, the inflexibility, the peculiar stereotype behaviors that are an inherent part of autism and are often quite disabling. So we're trying to understand not only the biological substrates of those, but perhaps how that contributes to the genotype of the disorder. And then we're doing also some preclinical studies with animals, looking at, we're working on a project to try to breed animals that may exhibit some of the symptoms of autism. Obviously, mice and rats can't do the same thing, but if we can build some models, then we may be able to think about both understanding causality, but also specific kinds of treatment for specific symptoms.
Were you one of the authors of the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, also known as ADOS?
Yes, I was.
Okay. What did your participation entail with that?
Well, from the beginning where we had to determine the items, the presses that are used in that, then executing them, then assessing whether they were working or not, and then restructuring it and doing it again until we found an instrument that was highly reliable and valid. So I was through most of the process.
Now, according to your CV, you've published over 120 articles related to child psychiatry. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, probably a few more since then.
Are those all peer-reviewed?
Yes.
Okay. Do any pertain to autism spectrum disorders?
Yes.
Okay. According to your CV, you've also published 20 books and book chapters. Does that sound correct?
It's about right.
Do any pertain to autism spectrum disorders?
I'm sure some of them do.
Now, according to your CV, you currently serve on the panel of professional advisors of the Autism Society of America. What is the Autism Society of America?
Well, it's a very large parent organization, an advocacy group that's concerned about the research, but also services, legislation related to individuals who have autism.
And what does it mean to serve on the panel of professional advisors?
I was invited to be part of a group that advises the organization on scientific matters. So they send questions to us, ask us to help them try to set scientific policy. We provide them advice and guidance. The organization sets it. It's not ours to do.
Your CV also states that you're currently a member of the Board of Advisors of the Association for Science in Autism Treatment. What is that?
It's another organization that's trying to look at evidence-based practices, and there's a group of advisors to them who review studies and try to help them ascertain whether they meet a sufficient scientific standard to become part of practice.
Are you a reviewer for any journals?
I review for lots of journals.
Could you name a few?
American Journal of Psychiatry, Archives of General Psychiatry, Journal Academy of Child Medicine Psychiatry, Journal of Child Psychology, Psychiatry, Allied Professions, New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of American Medical Association, Pediatrics.
That's enough.
Too many.
Now, your CV has been filed as Respondent's Exhibit DD in this case. Is Respondent's Exhibit DD an accurate summary of your publications, background, and experience?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Doctor, have you ever testified before in a court of law?
I have.
Approximately how many times?
Maybe 15 or 20 times.
Could you describe the types of cases?
Probably the two most common are cases related to child abuse and neglect or marriage and divorce cases. But I've also been involved in a few other odds and ends.
Have you ever testified in the vaccine program before?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Have you ever consulted for a pharmaceutical company?
I have.
Could you explain?
I've consulted with pharmaceutical companies on study design, and in most recently with Johnson & Johnson as we tried to help them bring risperidone to market. It's the first drug that has an FDA indication for autism, and they were going to drop that because it was about to go off patent, and so they tried to move it along, and some of us helped consult with getting that through the FDA process. So we now at least have one drug that's officially approved for autism.
And why did you agree to testify for the United States government in this litigation?
There are two reasons. One is a number of my colleagues asked me to do it and said that it was important, but I'm very concerned about families with kids with autism, and I'm concerned that they might be being led down the wrong track, and we work too damn hard to take care of them, to see them waste resources on things that are not helping them, and to put their kids in jeopardy is just not something I can stand. And so I think there's a chance to try to make a difference, so I'll try.
I'd like to turn now to the facts of this case, to the medical facts of Colin Dwyer. Did you review the medical records that have been filed in this case?
I reviewed the materials that were given to me, yes, ma'am.
And did you listen to the testimony of Maria Dwyer and Timothy Dwyer yesterday?
I certainly did.
Were you present in the courtroom?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And did you review the affidavits of Maria and Timothy Dwyer?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
Did you read the medical report filed by Dr. Elizabeth Mumper in this case?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
And were you present in the courtroom today to listen to Dr. Mumper's testimony?
Yes, ma'am, I was.
In your opinion, doctor, did Colin's receipt of thimerosal-containing vaccines cause or contribute to his autism?
No, ma'am.
Do you agree with the diagnosis of autism in this case?
I think it's highly likely, but it's not definitive.
In your opinion, has proper testing been done on Colin?
No, ma'am.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there are standard diagnostic procedures that are pretty much well accepted around the world, actually, for the proper diagnosis of autism. And the gold standard is using the Autism Diagnostic Interview, the ADI, and the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, jointly. But then you have to use collateral measures as well. Some of them have been done with called the Vineland social maturity scale, but cognitive testing is also an inherent part of the process because one has to be able to adjust the perspective on symptoms based on cognitive functioning and language ability. And the cognitive testing, proper cognitive testing, hasn't been done.
Over the course of your clinical practice, have you evaluated and treated children with the same symptoms as described in Colin Dwyer's medical records?
I would say Colin Dwyer's medical record is basically the record of most of the cases I've ever seen.
Is there anything unique or different about Colin's clinical course than in the autistic patients that you have in your practice?
No, ma'am.
Are you familiar with the term regressive autism?
Yes, ma'am, I've heard it.
When did you first hear that term?
It started in the late 1990s, early 2000 range.
In what context, do you know?
Well, when Andrew Wakefield was trying to make his case, the notion that there was a unique group of individuals who had a regression as part of their disorder that was separate from the rest of autism became part of the discussion. It never really entered the scientific community. There's no formal diagnosis called regressive autism, and most of us have not. Despite the fact that we tried very hard to see if this was a distinct phenotype, we haven't been able to support that. It would be useful if it was a distinct phenotype, but it turns out not to be.
Do you use the term regressive autism in your practice?
No, not at all.
From your review of the evidence, would you characterize Colin as having suffered a regression?
What I would characterize Colin as having is a progressive illness that included loss of some skills at certain points along the way, but it was a progressive process. It wasn't like he was motoring along, dropped off the edge of a cliff, and then went forward.
How would you describe Colin's condition?
Well, again, I haven't seen Colin, but at least from the records, it would sound like this is a child, as is often the case with autism, who had what was apparently a normal pregnancy and delivery with few odd things, but you know, not completely nonspecific, that then progressed. He looked like he was a normal baby at birth, and then things start to, you know, give you a hint that something's not quite right. So, again, one has the advantage of 20/20 hindsight as well, but when you look back, the growth curves start to slip shortly after 6 months. And
well, I'd like to ask you about that, because in your report you state that Colin's behavioral aspects associated with ASD may have begun as early as 6 months of age,
correct,
when he started to lose weight as demonstrated by growth charts.
Correct.
Could you explain what you meant by that in your report?
Well, if you look at his growth charts, he starts off with everything, his height, weight, and head circumference are all tightly linked together. And then starting shortly after 6 months, at least from the pediatrician's record, his weight starts to fall off, but his height and head circumference stays the same. And they only start to fall off some months later. And it's not uncommon for us to see kids with autism start to become finicky eaters, even as early as 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And so it's quite possible that the behavioral subtle, and no one might not have noticed it, just, you know, it was a little bit of a picky, it may have already started to affect the way he was eating or how much he was consuming, and so it just may have been the beginning of the fall off in his the progression of his illness.
You also state in your report that Colin has yet to receive fully appropriate cognitive assessments. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, I mean, the problem is that cognitive functioning, people in lay public sort of think of cognitive functioning as measured by IQ. And IQ is a single number. I mean, and it's not a very useful single number. It'd be kind of like telling you the score of a baseball game last night was 7. You know, does that mean there was one side had 7, another had nothing, or 4 plus 3? I mean, you don't know anything. And IQ is like that. But as it turns out, there are elements of cognitive functioning that are really quite crucial for adaptation. And when one designs intervention, you have to know those elements of functioning because you want to build on strength and you need to work around weakness. So when we do testing, what we want to do is look at an individual's verbal cognitive abilities, the things that we depend on language to manage. But then we also want to look at nonverbal cognitive abilities because sometimes we can, and those are things like mathematics or problem solving, puzzles and things like that. And we sometimes can take problems by teaching. If someone has verbal deficits, which is common in autism, we can then, and we understand what the verbal cognitive deficits are in an individual, we can sometimes twist those very tasks into nonverbal tasks and teach them how to manage certain things. But there's another part of it, and that is you need to know what someone's cognitive level is. If you think someone is a genius, but in fact they have an IQ of 50 or 60, making demands of them for an IQ of someone who would have 130 or 140 is unfair and unreasonable. And it's and commonly the case, it's also unfair and unreasonable for the families because it creates a set of expectations and demands that may be unreasonable, and then they have a sense of failure and not succeeding. So trying to understand really where the child fits developmentally at a cognitive level, cognitive functioning, as well as language functioning, as well as adaptive functioning, as well as behavioral functioning, is a critical part of getting the whole clinical picture.
Now, in your report, you state that Colin has autism spectrum disorder, likely comorbid with moderate mental retardation. And we heard testimony yesterday and today by Dr. Mumper that questions that conclusion. What's the basis for your conclusion that he may have moderate mental retardation?
So, again, because appropriate testing hasn't been done, I can't say that for sure, but there are 3 pieces of evidence, maybe 4. Piece of evidence number 1 is that autism is commonly comorbid with mental retardation. About 70, depends on what studies you look at or what surveys are, between 70 and 80% of individuals are comorbidly mental retardation. A range, but they're comorbid. Secondly, there were 2 tests that were done in the record. One was the Bayley Scales of Infant Development. And while it's not a great indicator of cognitive ability, when those were done, and I don't remember exactly when they were done, but the Bayley, I think the standard score was a 56 or 57, which would be in the moderate. It correlates roughly with IQ. Remember, I'm dubious about single numbers, but that would correlate roughly with an IQ in the 50s or maybe low 60s, which would be mild to moderate mental retardation. Similarly, there was a Stanford-Binet test done at one point, which is also a cognitive measure, and that was in the same range. Again, Stanford-Binet has a set of problems, single number, how much is verbal because he has verbal problems and understanding the verbal testing and so on is an issue, but at least it points in that direction. And then if you look at his Vineland's repeatedly, his adaptive functioning scales, they're all in a rather low range, which would put him, again, consistent with someone who had had mild to moderate mental retardation, probably moderate. But in the until one does the right tests, you can't say for sure, but all those indications would strongly suggest that you need to do those tests so you know what you're dealing with.
And we heard testimony that because Colin responded to PECS therapy, that is evidence that he has proper cognitive functioning. Do you agree with that?
It's not an indicator of that at all. We use PECS for individuals with mental retardation as
What is PECS?
PECS is P-E-C-S. It's Picture Exchange Communication System. And basically, it's you give individuals, you can do it a number of ways, but they're basically drawings that an individual can pass to somebody to say, you know, I want a cookie. So they go through and they give you a thing for a cookie, or you can use it for schedules and tasks. And it's a way of communicating that doesn't require the production of words. And it largely uses iconic images, although, I mean, pictures, sometimes literally photographs and sometimes ideographic drawings. And for some kids, use words as well as the drawings because they can read, but they can't speak the words. So there are large different groups of kids can use this kind of exchange system as a way to communicate along the way. And the reason it's so important is communication is crucial because oftentimes we see kids with autism who have difficulty communicating, becomes very frustrating. That leaves the serious behavior problems because they can't tell you what they want or how they're feeling or what they need or that they don't want to do arithmetic or they don't want to go outside. So if they can show you that, sometimes it or you, when you can give them a choice of options that they want to pursue, it sometimes makes it a lot easier for them. A lot of times, and it makes it a lot easier for the rest of us because we know what they're thinking and feeling. We can then interact with them.
And is PECS used for children with mental retardation as well?
All the time, sure.
You also mentioned in your report that Colin has not had appropriate genetic testing. Could you explain why that's important?
Well, first of all, the current best view of autism is that it's a genetic disorder, but more importantly, there are a number of genetic conditions that are associated with autism specifically, and for those, there are discrete genetic markers, and we'd want to know that. And in particular, Fragile X syndrome, which is highly associated with autism. There's a genetic abnormality on chromosome 15q that is associated with autism, and it's important to know that because people who have the 15q duplication are at high risk for sudden death, and we need to monitor them for cardiac deficits, so we want to check for that. And then tuberous sclerosis is associated with autism, and there are genes for tuberous sclerosis, and those need to be looked for. And there are a number of other possible genetic variants that are associated with the disorder, and it's becoming there, and they're coming faster and faster and faster. So in the next year or two, we'll probably have more variants that we'll know about, and going ahead and doing the testing so we have markers helps us know which kids to call in when we have a finding. So, for example, we discovered the 15q abnormality, and then we discovered the sudden death thing. So now we can go to our registry of all the kids that we've seen and tested, and all the ones that are 15q, we've notified all those families that they're at increased risk for sudden death so that we can deal with that. The same thing with Fragile X. There's now, it's not here yet, but there's a treatment in animals with Fragile X that actually remediate some of the disabilities associated with Fragile X. And I would expect in a not-too-distant future we're going to see human trials and being able to find those families quickly and say, your child has Fragile X, here's a study, here's a possible treatment. We want to be able to make that available as instantly as we possibly, as quickly as we possibly can.
The fact that none of Colin's physicians has recommended the genetic testing be done, is that evidence that the testing is unnecessary?
No, it's completely necessary. I mean, listen, for me, the gold standard, what would I do for my child? I would definitely have my child genetically tested. I mean, for all the blood draws and sticks he's had, you know, you could get the blood easily. Frankly, you could do it from a swab of his buccal mucosa, his cheek. And so it's non-invasive, easy to do, and not terribly expensive, and given what else he's been spent on him.
Now, Dr. Mumper relies very heavily on the various laboratory reports in this case to support her hypothesis. And she talked today about that she doesn't rely on single laboratory results, but a constellation of labs, or the labs in concert. If this were your patient and you were presented with these laboratory results, what would you recommend be done?
In response to these laboratory results?
Yes, sir.
I don't think any of them are particularly pertinent to this clinical case. I probably wouldn't have ordered most of them. And the ones that are there, where there are abnormalities, so-called abnormalities are at the margins. But even then, I mean, one of the things we're taught in medical school, what we teach our students is that, you know, clinical practice isn't driven by a lab test. Clinical practice is driven by the care of the patient. So you have to take a laboratory finding and correlate it with some kind of finding in a patient. And just because you have an abnormal lab finding, or particularly a marginally abnormal lab finding, may have no relevance at all to the practice and what you actually do, or what it means in terms of a causal relationship for the patient. And in this case, looking at all these labs, I didn't find any of them particularly relevant to the case at hand.
If Colin were your patient, would you order, in any of your autistic patients, would you order that such labs be done?
I want to say something maybe a little bit odd, but we don't actually, I don't use the term autistic patients.
Talk about
children who have autism, because they're children, they're people first. They haven't had a disease, but they're first of all people. And I think to just say they're autistic is too dismissive and not fair. So they often have ideas and opinions, sense of humor, preferences, and I think we often forget that because we think they just sit in corners and twiddle, and that's not what they do. Sorry.
No, that's an excellent point. Let me rephrase. The autistic children that you have in your practice, would you order such laboratory testing be done?
I wouldn't order, for children with autism, I wouldn't order most of the laboratory tests that were ordered here. They're just unnecessary. There's some that might be useful, but not most of them are not useful.
If you thought that a child with autism had neuroinflammation, what would you recommend be done?
Well, I would do several things. First of all, I would consult with a neurologist. Although I do a lot of work with these kids and basically know what to do. You know, I always think two heads is better than one, so I might as well get someone else to think along with me. I would do an LP, though.
What's an LP?
Lumbar puncture. I'd get spinal fluid. I mean, why take a peripheral measure or a guess when you can go as close to the source as you can and look in the spinal fluid? And you can almost always, when there's inflammation, find that. And then I would probably seriously think about doing a brain scan of some kind. And in the kinds of inflammation that have been talked about here, you'd almost have a high probability of finding that on an MRI or one other kind of, there are other scanning techniques that one could use to see things like gliosis or inflammation in certain areas.
Doctor, if you saw a blood test that was 4 times the normal range, would that mean that the results were abnormal?
No.
Why not?
Well, because why something has a particular value depends on lots of factors. Let me give you an example. If we had a child who had not eaten, you saw him first thing in the morning and hadn't eaten all night, you might get a blood sugar of 60, 70, and then you gave him a bowl of frosted mini wheats and took his blood again, he'd have a blood sugar of 300, 350. That would be completely normal, because in the context in which that occurs, it could be completely normal. So you have to understand both the, if you will, the metabolism of sugar and how that gets managed, but also the conditions, the context in which it took place.
Just because a child is smaller than an adult, does that mean that the reference ranges for their laboratory values would be lower?
No, not at all. I mean, you can't make that assumption at all. In some cases, their reference ranges are higher. In some cases, they're lower. It depends on what the measure is. And for example, some liver enzymes, kids are actually, their livers work a lot better than adults because they haven't been damaged by alcohol and cigarettes and all the stuff that adults do to damage their livers, and so they actually can metabolize drugs faster in some cases, and their liver enzymes may be higher. In some cases, they're lower. It depends on what the particular index is, and also depends on a particular level of functioning. So, for example, a child who's crying, their CO2 level will be different than a child who's not crying, or a child who's been running around a lot, their lactic acid level will be different. And so it's context and what the pathophysiology of the particular measure is before you need to know both. And thirdly, you have to know development. And developmental ages, things change over time.
In your report, you also mentioned that dysmorphology exam was not detailed enough, or it's unclear from the records how detailed the dysmorphology exam was. Why is that an important examination that should be done on a child with autism?
Because the way we look and our body forms often is reflective of events that may have occurred in utero, some of them genetically determined, some determined by other factors as well. And so when we have a child who has a developmental disturbance, because external manifestations of the central nervous system may be seen in skin development or in development of particularly the face and head, we have to look very, very carefully to make sure that there aren't any abnormalities that are commonly associated with syndromes. And in fact, the pictures were very cute and very difficult to discern because they went by very quickly yesterday, but just in my quick look at it, there's maybe that his ears are a little bit low and turned posteriorly. That could mean something of profound importance clinically, and it looks like his eyes may have been a little bit wide set. Well, someone has to sit down and actually do those measurements and look at other parts of his body. He could have certain kinds of pigmentation that might be consistent with certain neurologic diseases that reflect themselves in the skin. One is tuberous sclerosis. It requires something called a Wood's lamp examination to see if that pigmentation change is taking place in the skin. So you have to look for all these things to make sure that you understand every possible thing that's associated with disorder.
And you're not diagnosing a dysmorphic condition in Colin based on the pictures, are you?
No, not at all. But it just, for me, reinforced my concern that it wasn't done meticulously. And there are people who are quite specialized at this. I'm okay at it, but if I wasn't sure, I would send them to a dysmorphologist.
Doctor, do you find any clinical or scientific evidence in this record that would lead you to believe more probably than not that Colin's autism was caused by thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I don't think there's any evidence that's caused by thimerosal-containing vaccine.
The hypotheses that Dr. Mumper has put forward in her report and that she testified to today regarding her belief that Colin's autism was caused by thimerosal-containing vaccines, are those hypotheses generally accepted in the autism medical community?
No, they're not.
I have no further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Powers, do you need a recess before we begin?
Taking the words out of my mouth, Special Master, I would appreciate a recess.
How much time would you like?
Can we say 45 minutes? That would give a chance to actually grab a quick bite to eat, and I don't expect my cross is going to be much longer than the direct.
Any problem with that? That takes us to 1. You need to get Dr. Leventhal out of here by 3, as I understand it.
Correct. That's okay.
Okay. All right, we'll reconvene then at 12:30.